You don't have staff. Mm-hmm.
The Joint Committee on Tax Credits will come to order. It's April 23rd, 2015. We're going to hear from Legislative Council. Paul, do you want to introduce our discussion this morning?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. In your meeting last Thursday, you had discussed some of the options and flexibility around combining the credits in an individual bill, which has been the precedent taken by the Joint Committee in the past. So the question came up, what kind of flexibility do you have in terms of a majority vote and three-fifths supermajority requirements when it comes to combining these kinds of bills? So you had asked me to ask Dexter to come in, the resident expert on these issues.
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And I certainly would not characterize myself as the resident expert on this because there's a lot of unknowns in this area, actually. Just to set the stage, I think you're all aware of this, but there are actually two provisions in the Oregon Constitution that use the term bill for raising revenue. The first has been in the Constitution since statehood began, and it requires bills for raising revenue to originate in the House of Representatives. That's called the Origination Clause. Very few cases address that, but a handful over the years. And then in 1996, voters approved a legislative referral that added a second provision to the Oregon Constitution using that term bill for raising revenue. And it says that a bill for raising revenue for passage must achieve a three-fifths vote in each house. And since that time, there has actually only been one case, Bobo versus Kulongoski, that went all the way to the Supreme Court that made a ruling on what the phrase bill for raising revenue means. So that's our primary source of authority for what that is. And under the Bobo case, there's two tests. First, the first question is, does the particular bill in question bring revenue into the Treasury? And if it does not, that ends the matter. And then the second test is, if it brings revenue into the Treasury, does the bill have the features that essentially as a tax, that is to say, something that extracts a payment from whoever is making the payment, for which they do not get any particular benefit in return? In other words, if they didn't make that payment, do they, in fact, not forego a benefit? That is the essential characteristic of a tax. You pay, but you don't get a direct benefit for that payment. So with those two things in mind, the question that I understand the committee is asking is what's the guidance when you have a single bill that has both revenue increases and extensions of tax credits that reduce revenue coming in, so that the net effect of the bill is something that is revenue neutral. And based on that first tier that I mentioned, that in order for it to be a bill for raising revenue, it must bring money into the Treasury. Well, if it's revenue neutral, it's not bringing money into the Treasury, and therefore is not a bill for raising revenue. That's essential principle that I see here. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just to clarify for one of the newbies, so and that and what you said about a tax feature extracting a payment for which you get no benefit, that is the clear line that divides a tax versus a fee. Because a fee, whether it's for a license or something, you can clearly demonstrate that if you did not pay this fee, you would not get that license or you would not be able to whatever. Is that is my understanding of that correct?
Co-chair is Representative Smith Warner. Yes, that is, that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dexter, for the work. So we call these things tax expenditures. That is something that we do to cause an outcome by spending the state's money, don't we?
Mr. Co-chair, Representative Benz, a tax expenditure is something where you are, in order to achieve a particular outcome, you are allowing taxpayers to do something that allows them to reduce their taxes that they would otherwise pay.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Who's spending the money? We say tax expenditure. Who's spending the money?
Representative Benz, it is the taxpayer that is has to engage in doing something that allows them to claim a reduction in their tax. So in that sense, I would not say that all tax expenditures actually require an expenditure. It requires conduct, typically. That may be spending money. It may be doing something else. But it is the taxpayer that is, in most instances, is doing something, and in most instances is actually paying.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
I'm not sure that responded to the question. The question is, we have a big book. It's about an inch thick. It says tax expenditures on it. I don't think that term is being used to suggest that the taxpayer is spending the money. I think it's to suggest that we, the state, have chosen to prompt a certain types of activity, and in return, we spend the state's money by reducing that person's entity's taxes. That's how I have taken it, but do I have that wrong? Does that tax expenditure mean we are really having all of those taxpayers out there spending their money on windmills and whatnot rather than spending their money on taxes? Is that the way I'm to take that book?
Representative Benz, there is no such thing as a tax expenditure for which that isn't ultimately tied to a statute that says if you do this, taxpayer, you can reduce your taxes this way. So everything is statutory. It's all entirely in your control.
A follow up?
Yes, please.
Again, I haven't heard the answer. Who's spending the money?
Well, Representative Benz, I'll just lay out what I think is a typical tax expenditure, namely a tax credit. And you have a tax credit that says if you, taxpayer, do this, and it typically involves spending money and spend X amount, then you can reduce your taxes by, sometimes it's the same amount, sometimes it's a different amount. And so the taxes that would otherwise go to the state no longer get there. It is based on a statute. It must be. But it is typically, physically, the taxpayer that is doing something else with their money other than giving to the state.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I must say that's not how I've understood it. I have understood the, quote, tax expenditures to be a method of the state determining how the state would spend money which otherwise would come through the door as taxes. So what we do here is we suggest to ourselves that, gosh, it would be a great idea to have, I know, an earned income tax credit. And so what we say is if you get a job and you work, then we are going to not only reduce your taxes, we're going to send you a check. It looks to me like in that instance, it's the state spending the money. And then, and likewise, if we were going to prompt an outcome, for example, the VETC, where we wanted to have green energy, we said to ourselves, hey, let's go ahead as a state and allow folks who engage in building wind towers or whatever, and we will allow them to sell these tax credits, generate money with them from people who otherwise would have paid taxes. And it seemed to me that that was a choice this group was making, the legislature, in spending those dollars that otherwise would have come through the door. That's how I've always taken a tax expenditure conversation. But maybe I have it wrong, and that's why I'm asking.
Representative Benz, actually, I think you and I are saying the same thing. All tax expenditures must be rooted in some kind of statutory authority. That is, and it's the legislature that makes those laws. The earned income credit that you raise as an example is a unique subset of that. That's called a refundable tax credit, where you are absolutely correct that some of the monies in that do, in fact, go directly from the state to the taxpayer. But that's an unusual case. There are only a handful of refundable tax credits. Most tax credits do involve much more like the Betsy or something, where you have a taxpayer that, rather than paying taxes, is in doing something else with that money and can therefore claim it.
One final question.
Yep.
So the definition, which I didn't bring with me, of a tax credit suggests that it's a credit against, quote, an established tax. And there's a reason for the word established being there, because that's a consistent understanding by the state that through that established tax, those dollars are going to come through the door. That's why they use the word established. At least that's why I assume it. And that would mean, again, that when we give a credit against, quote, an established tax, we, the state, are spending that money in a way other than would have been the case, perhaps, if we'd allowed the money to come through the door. By reducing an by giving the taxpayer the opportunity to reduce that, quote, exposure to an established tax. It can be taken a number of other ways. But again, in each instance, it occurs to me that the state is making a decision to spend the state's money in a certain way. And again, I want to reemphasize that from my standpoint, a tax credit is a decision by the state to spend its money in a certain way, and that's why we call them tax expenditures. And if I've got it wrong, I need to have you clarify it, and that's why I'm so happy to have you here today to help us with this, because it's an extraordinarily important issue.
Representative Benz, again, I think, well, I'll return then to the first tier of the Bobo analysis, which is, in order for it to be a bill for raising revenue, which is the fundamental issue here, it must have revenues coming in to the Treasury. And a tax expenditure reduces the revenues that come into the Treasury.
Sure. Forgive me, but I do have another question. So what you're saying is that if the money you, as a taxpayer, owe to the state, we say to you, you need to send that to us unless you engage in building a windmill, in which event you can utilize that money to build the windmill. Now, you say, okay, I'm going to do that. Because why? We're going to give you money or let you keep part of it. What just happened? Did that fiction that we didn't have you send the check first to us and then we turned around and sent it back to you mean that somehow it was not a tax expenditure or a tax? It seems odd to me that we would resort to that type of, I hate to say fiction, but it'll do for the moment. It seems to me that we have exercised control over those dollars. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've spent them. Now, because we certainly, had we done nothing, the money would have come in. They wouldn't have had the tax credit. Mm-hmm. So how could it not be us exercising control over those dollars? And thus, it's the same as having it come into, quote, the Treasury.
Mm-hmm. Representative Benz, but it appears there's a fiction either way, because it does not actually come into the Treasury. And that, before you get to the, under Bobo, before you get to the question of whether it's a tax, it has to come into the Treasury. And it does not, in your example of the windmill. The money does not actually come into the Treasury.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards, please. I'm going in order of hands.
So does the...
Sorry, Senator Edwards.
I forgot my... That's fine. I don't really care. So does the threshold question about whether or not money is coming into the Treasury for in terms of whether or not it's a bill to raise revenue, does that only apply to the coming biennium, or is that, can you, in that analysis, if one legislature cannot bind a subsequent legislature, what is the time frame over which that mm-hmm. analysis is made, since we have tax credits with long tails on them and a policy that looks at them over subsequent biennia? Mm-hmm.
Co-Chair Senator Edwards, excellent question. the only guidance we have is the text of the Constitution. That is to say, you measure this on the basis of a bill. And the bill, when you have a I think your question is, what happens if you have, say, a tax rate increase or something like that that is goes on in perpetuity, and tax credits that are sunsetted at a date in the future, but not in perpetuity, and it's the credits and the rate increase that are the basis for the neutrality. But because the rate increase is in perpetuity, and the tax credits are only for a limited period, because the Constitution, the question is based on the bill, it seems to me that that is the time period. It is whatever the bill contemplates, which, if something is in perpetuity, that is in perpetuity.
Representative Baker Peterson?
I didn't have
it. Oh, you didn't? Okay. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Council, you used the term, I'm trying to get this down to English for the people out there in the common world. And I think it's the Chief Justice, at least all three of them said it's the word of the law here. And so you made mention new or revenue into the Treasury. So if I pay tax, if my taxes, if I'm paying $1,000 in taxes this year and we increase taxes and I have to send $1,200, that's another $200 into the Treasury. Am I not correct?
Co-Chair Senator Boquist, assuming no other facts have changed, like your income is, one, we're talking about income, two, your income remains the same.
Yeah.
And you cut, a legislative change is made that results in you paying $200 more. That would be an increase into the Treasury, yes.
Follow up, Mr. Sure.
Yes, here. Please. Uh-huh.
Okay, so you made mention of you could have a bill, and this is the crux of the issue here, so let's not mince words. You could approve $60 million in tax credits in a bill, one of these two House bills. We no fooling anybody here. We have two House bill numbers. We know what the numbers are, okay? And then what I think I hear you saying is that you could then turn around and increase the income tax, my income tax, personal income tax, by an equal amount of those $60 million in credits. And that would not be a revenue-raising bill. So I'd like you to clarify how we're putting more money into the Treasury, one, and two, are you making a legal difference between new revenue and replacement revenue?
Senator Boquist, I think to respond, I don't think you've given us, you've given me enough information to actually answer.
Yep, please.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So let's brass tacks. Let's go back to the very simple question. We have before us, this committee was given $14 million supposedly by the co-chairs of joint ways and means to spend on tax credits. I personally have no legal, moral, or representative obligation to listen to whatever they have to say. This is a separate committee, and if they want to do that, that's fine, or we can tell them to go pound sand. Now what we have is a gimmick, and let's just, whatever we're going to call this, you have said to this committee, correct me if I'm wrong, if we increased in theory gave $50 million in tax credits, and then this committee raised a tax someplace else, income, corporate, whatever you want to call it, to equal $50 million, the two of those equal each other, you're saying that that is not a revenue-raising bill. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, Senator Boquist, assuming we don't get into one of these timing issues so that all of this takes place over a single biennium and then everything goes away, that is correct.
Follow?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So it's not really revenue into the Treasury then, is not the legal argument, because it's new revenue into the Treasury. There's no doubt about that. The revenue goes into the Treasury from certain individuals in the state, certain classes of the state. And it's sent the then offset in another class of the state. and distributed elsewhere.
Let's just, one of them, the biggest one, I think all of us, very few people in this committee, I think, will vote no, and that's my personal opinion. You can vote how you want. Is we have, you know, earned income tax credit for low-income single mothers and disabled children. There's an example. That's the category of individual. We want to preserve that credit hypothetically. In order to preserve that credit, we have to come up with an offset in layman terms, and that means we have to increase a tax someplace else.
Now, since we're giving them a credit, we're not going to increase the tax on them. We're going to increase the tax on another class of individuals, basically another bracket in the tax bracket. They're going to have an increase of revenue into the Treasury. The other one is going to get the credit, as was said earlier. And so I'm looking for a better definition, not disputing whether, and that's the difference between new and replacement, because we're really replacing is what we're doing. It is an increase of revenue into the Treasury from a different source, but we're backfilling it and replacing another. Is that really the correct analogy? Or do you want to get back later?
No, I mean, I understand your question, Senator, and it is, I think, because the Constitution uses the word bill, the fact that different groups of taxpayers are affected differently, but the net result is a revenue neutral piece, no new revenue coming in. My opinion is that that's not a three-fifths. That's not a bill for raising revenue. Now, I, if I may, just continue on a little. This is a great example of where there's a little problem in the procedures here. Most of the time, you're all aware of the role of legislative counsel, which is to advise you, typically confidentially, on what our opinion of something is. But because of chamber rules, in this one area, we announce kind of our opinion. We've been directed to announce our opinion in this very short four or five words that is in the title of the bill. And that has the effect of, there are many, you know, this is a very complicated area where there are many ways you can look at it. And that has the effect of us most of the time having the last word, where really it is the Supreme Court that appropriately should have the last word in this. But because of the way this works, that it would only be if in a very extremely unlikely set of circumstances that a claim would go to the Supreme Court, we end up with this a lot of unanswered questions, really, that are unanswerable. You make very colorable arguments that something isn't a bill for raising revenue. I think it's a little more likely that it is, but we don't know, and we can't know until we get more guidance from the Supreme Court.
I have one final question.
Yes, please.
Just for clarity's sake,
am I correct in them saying the summary here is that if you have one of these two House bills before this committee and you raise and you approve tax credits in any amount and you increase a tax increase on some class of citizen to an equal amount, so the two are equal, and they are in this biennium, not a future biennium, therefore not binding a future group of entities, that requires a 31-16 vote in the respective chambers. Is that correct?
Co-Chair Senator Boquist, that is correct. Again, assuming we are not talking about the situation that I think Senator Edwards was asking about.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Senator Riley, please.
Actually, Senator Boquist covered what I wanted to ask.
Senator Breshugger, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Johnson, if you stated that a tax expenditure decreases revenue, so a bill that would eliminate a tax expenditure, would that be a revenue-raising bill?
Co-chairs, Senator Berchiger, yes.
Follow up?
Please.
Would that bill have to originate in the House?
Yes, it would.
Thank you, Co-Chair.
Senator Riley?
Yes, that brought up a whole other question. I want to understand what you just said. You said if we pass a bill that eliminates a tax expenditure, then that's raising revenue. But if we do nothing and that tax expenditure goes away by sunset, that's not a tax-raising measure. Is that correct?
Co-Chair, Senator Riley, if you have a tax credit, it does not have a sunset in it, which in these day and age is unusual.
Yes.
And then you put one on, even if it's 6 years in the future, I would say that is a bill for raising revenue. However, now that most tax credits have sunsets,
mm-hmm.
An act to merely extend the sunset 6 years into the future would be essentially maintaining the status quo for an additional 6 years. And so that would not be a bill for raising revenue.
Thank you.
All right,
one
question.
Co-Chair?
Oh, thank Co-Vice you. Co-Chair.
Co-Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barnhart. And Dexter, thank you very much for being here and testifying today. Can you clarify the extent to which these issues have been litigated? Thank you for your analysis of the Supreme Court case, but to what extent are we resting on firm, established constitutional grounds by the Oregon Supreme Court with respect to the, really, I think, the core question of a single bill that in a single biennium offsets an increase in revenue with a extension of a tax credit?
Co-chairs,
has that specific question been decided?
Yeah. Co-chairs, Representative Davis, no. And in fact, that is part of my conversation with respect to Senator Boquist's question, is that the way this works, where you're identifying, where you have legislative counsel identify its opinion that something is a bill for raising revenue or not, and put that in the title of the bill, has the effect of causing it to be very unlikely that it's ever going to get litigated.
Interesting. Follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So that has not been decided by the Oregon Supreme Court, and then by implication, the larger question of if we were to sort of move around revenue outside of a single biennium, so sort of pulling forward cash, so to speak, to offset a revenue increase, that has not been decided by the Oregon Supreme Court either.
Co-chairs, Representative Davis, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. And just a comment?
Yes, please.
I want to thank legislative counsel for being here. Respect his opinion greatly, respect the fact that this is not a litigated issue, but I'm troubled very much by the idea that there might be an attempt to use a sleight of hand or an illusion of a extension of an expenditure or a credit to offset a tax increase and get by what Oregon voters enacted in the 1990s. I certainly strongly doubt that was the intent of the voters.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Yes. Since I'm new, I just want to kind of try and understand what you were saying in the beginning. So revenue is not allocated to a particular issue, but to the Treasury. Is that what you said in the beginning?
Okay. Co-chairs, Representative Whitsitt, yes, under the analysis laid out by the Supreme Court, the first inquiry is, does revenue come into the Treasury? Not necessarily where it's allocated. In fact, it doesn't even use the term state treasury. So it could be if you had a state directed tax that went to local treasuries, that would still, I think, satisfy that requirement.
Okay, so I kind of have a series of back and forth.
Please go ahead.
So I can understand. So would you agree that it benefits all citizens of the state as such?
Clarifying question, Representative. You said it. What is it?
The revenue that comes into the state. is for the benefit of all of the citizens of the state?
Well, that depends on what choices the legislature makes and how the money is then spent.
Just as a general class, revenue comes in and it's not, when it comes in, it's not specifically allocated to something. That's up to us to do.
That's the overall scheme.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand. Yeah. So then a tax expenditure, according to your first argument, would be given or allocated to a particular issue or individual. Is that correct? It's not for the benefit of all of the citizens of the state, according to your first argument.
Co-chairs, Representative Whitsitt, I think you can presume that any legislative act is for the benefit of the state, kind of in a vague sense. And as I said, all tax expenditures must be grounded in some kind of statutory basis, some choice that the legislature made.
But they go to individuals or corporations. Specifically, they don't all go back out to all of the citizens that, or corporations that contribute revenue. What I'm trying to figure out is these two things don't seem equal. One, you're trying to make them equal, but one is the state. The other are separate entities. The expenditures go out to entities, but the revenue comes in to the state, and that's not... To me, that's not equal. I mean, there's a difference there.
Yeah. Co-chairs, Representative Whitsitt, there's another provision in the Constitution at play here that requires a uniform system of taxation that would actually prohibit the legislature from saying, taxpayer X, you get a tax credit. Instead, tax credits or other tax expenditures are written in general terms, that if anyone meets certain criteria and qualifications, they're eligible for a tax credit.
Wouldn't that be a class? Wouldn't that be a class, then, of individuals or corporations?
Representative, could you wrap it up?
Okay,
we do have three different concepts to hear today.
I'm just trying to understand. In my mind, these things are not equal. One is to a class, the expenditures are to a class, and the revenue is to the citizenry. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you. I simply wanted to note that the issue that you raised having to do with the requirement in the rules to label a bill as a bill for raising revenue has the effect of making it almost impossible to get litigated answers to these kinds of questions that we've been discussing. Speaker Merkley tried very tied us in knots on the floor on several occasions, trying to figure out how to get a justiciable question through a bill out of the House, out of the Senate, and then it to a place where it could be litigated, and failed. And so I think the point you raise about the rule is a good one. We will continue to be groping around this issue until these things actually get litigated and we get a guidance from the court. I think that given the experience that we had in 2007, that seems very unlikely to me anytime soon. And that's just a comment, doesn't require a response. Thank you very much for your help this morning. And with
Thank
that,
you.
We'll open the... colleagues, we have three concepts to deal with today. The first one has to do with individual retirement accounts, and so we're going to open the three bills that relate to that issue. So we're opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 50, Senate Bill 51, and House Bill 2011. Chris, do you want to just talk about those for us?
Sure. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In OLIS, under, I think as the committee is aware, we have some materials under meeting materials and under individual bills. And if a document pertains to a particular bill, it's under the bill. Otherwise, it's under meeting materials. So what I've put together here are, by concept, a summary sheet for each of the three concepts you have today. So under meeting materials, there is a document entitled Summary for SB 50, 51, and 2011. I've just tried to boil down into a one-pager the key concepts or questions before you. And so in this document, it outlines the two IDA tax credits, the Individual Development Account tax credits. One is a tax credit for contributions into the fund. Taxpayers can get a credit equal to 75% of their contribution, up to $75,000. And the second tax credit is one for the participants in the program. If they make a withdrawal for certain purchases, basically for a primary residence, then they get a tax credit up to $2,000 to contribute toward the costs of purchasing that home. The next section on that are kind of a bullet point approach to the proposed changes. Really just trying to provide kind of a Cliff Notes version of what you have before you. So it identifies the two extensions. It's the standard six-year extension. And then that's items one and two. And then items three and four are other changes that you will hear about. Senate Bill 50 and 51 are simply the sunset extensions. Those were the committee bills. House Bill 2011 makes some other changes, and those are the ones that are identified there. And then the next piece on this sheet is just a couple of graphs that show the historical use of the tax credit to get you a sense for the revenue, the related revenues. And then there is a table there with some preliminary revenue impacts. These are basically just the impacts that were put on the light statements as they moved to the committee. One thing to note about this is there's a program cap that isn't in statute. I think you're going to hear some more details about that. And at the end, there are a couple of technical considerations for the committee there that aren't necessarily policy related, but it's an intersection of some of these policies and how they intersect with other aspects of tax law. So that discussion is a little bit independent of the policy before you per se. So that's why it's at the end there under technical considerations.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes. I would be happy to make a couple comments from here or go around.
I think you should just go ahead from there.
Okay.
We have several other witnesses to hear.
Of course. Well, I'm happy that we're hearing House Bill 2011. I think it's a good, obviously, Chris gave a good summary of the history of the individual development accounts. It has a long history in Oregon. I'm speaking primarily from the experience we had in the Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development Committee, considering the bill and its contents. What really strikes me is the effect of the program that's based on matched savings and the combination of counseling and training that is coupled with the financial incentive. I think we're going to hear a lot of stories about the effect this program has. I was impressed with how far its reach extends throughout the state and the way that the program works with community-based entities around the state to help people get started on how to improve their own financial security and situation. So our committee was convinced without objection, without any opposition, that we needed to extend the sunset, to expand the list of approved uses for the proceeds, and to lift the cap a bit. As Chris mentioned, it's I'm not aware of any other credit where the cap is not in statute. That's an interesting discussion for this committee, whether that needs to be in statute or continue to operate as it has. But the stories of how it works are really impressive, and I think we're going to hear that today. And I appreciate you letting me say something about it.
Great. Thank you very much. We have 6 witnesses on one and 7 on the I'm sorry?
They're all the same people on all three lists.
Well, not quite. They're close.
Yeah.
They're close to the same people. It looks to me as though there are three who were signed up in the same handwriting. Jessica, Josie, and Heidi, do you want to come up together? Was that your hope?
I think we could do 3 panels of 3, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so we'll start at the top. Start at the top. Claire, Jessica, and Heidi. And you'll forgive me, some of the last names are not sure I can pronounce those.
So good morning, everyone, Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Haas and committee members. I'm very pleased to be here this morning. My name is Claire Seguin, and I'm the Assistant Director of Housing Stabilization at Oregon Housing and Community Services. And the IDA program is a program that I am very, very lucky to get to oversee in my role at Oregon Housing and Community Services. So I'm here to share with you just some basic information this morning, and then we're going to hear from the experts and the participants about their individual experiences and management styles about the program. But to start off with, I just wanted to outline the purpose of the program. It's first and foremost an asset building strategy for Oregonians. It's a matched savings program, a 3-to-1 match once the participants achieve educational goals and savings goals. Because it pairs education and savings, it has incredible impacts to help move people towards dreams for their families and financial goals over time. And that's one of the reasons, as Representative Reed said, that makes it such a special program. This program is available to folks who are 12 years and older, so it has a broad reach. It is available to folks at the income limit of 80% area median and 200% of poverty level, federal poverty level. And then the current types of IDA asset classes that we have right now are home ownership, small business, education, home repair, and adaptive equipment. The basic program structure is that a nonprofit, and in this case Neighborhood Partnerships, they manage the program. Oregon Housing and Community Services oversees the program, and then together we implement the entire initiative statewide through our nonprofit partners. The neighborhood partnership relationship has been in place since 2003, and from our perspective, they do a wonderful job of running this program and communicating with the community members and our nonprofit partners in terms of assessing need and program dynamics and course corrections and whatnot. They just do a stellar job, really, with the program. The funding for the program, as you probably know, is from a 75% tax credit, and the dollars that come in from the donors are used to provide the resources for the program administration, program delivery, and the matching funds. So this program is an essential program of Oregon Housing and Community Services housing stability approach. We believe that it is a really dynamic way to help people move to financial stability. And the thing about IDAs that is particularly wonderful is that it is a long-lasting program. It goes far beyond the initial participation and investment that we all make in this program. It lasts for a lifetime, it changes habits, and we believe it's an essential part of our pathway out of prosperity for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Hi. My Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Haas, and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Yunke. I'm the Director of Economic Opportunity with Neighborhood Partnerships, as Ms. Seguin said. NP's the statewide administrator of the Oregon IDA Initiative. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We know that Oregon communities thrive when people with lower incomes have the opportunity to build more stable financial households through asset building programs like the Oregon IDA Initiative. And we hope to have your support in renewing and expanding this proven tool. So with our partners from across the state, over the past year or more, we've developed all of the proposals that are incorporated into House Bill 2011, which is our priority bill. Senate Bills 50 and 51, as has been mentioned already, renew our legislation as it sits now. So today we're going to share with you an overview of how the initiative works, a sense of the impacts that we're having in communities across the state, as well as, of course, the specifics of our legislative proposal. We've each prepared short statements out of respect to your time constraints, and Neighborhood Partnerships Executive Director at the end will be able, Janet Bird, will be able to take questions. So as many of you know, an IDA, or an individual development account, is the actual account that's opened at a financial institution for an Oregonian with low household incomes, as well as an eligible net worth of less than $20,000. Each participant starts with one of the five goals that Claire mentioned already, and that savings goal is woven through a personal development plan plan, which guides the client's journey. And that plan includes financial education, coaching, and counseling specific to that goal, as well as, of course, the required monthly savings deposits into the account that accrue over time. After they've completed all of those requirements from the personal development plan, the participant savings is then eligible for matching dollars from the state that go directly to the vendor of the approved asset purchase. So IDAs with this structure really meet participants where they are at when they come in the door of our service providers, building off the goals that they already have. And because of those five potential savings goals paired with the education requirements, our partners have found a lot of success in tailoring the program to fit different communities across the state while still meeting the core standards of the Oregon IDA initiative. And we've found that that really strong foundation in the IDA can be built off of to adjust to all of the communities that we serve. So, for example, we have a really flourishing project right now on the Warm Springs Reservation that includes a culturally specific curriculum for Native people designed by Native people. And this educational piece reflects history and context relevant to their community and leads to greater, more lasting impacts on building those more stable financial households. Another example of this flexibility that we're very proud of is our growing partnership with the Oregon Youth Authority at the McLaren Youth Correctional Facility, which is offering educational IDAs to currently incarcerated young people who are saving the money they earn in facility while learning skills to build that stronger future for themselves once they re-enter society. So the flexibility, again, of the IDA is allowing us to meet the needs of families and communities across the state, from Enterprise to Eugene and almost everywhere in between. So expanding the allowable asset classes, which we'll go into more depth later, through House Bill 2011 will build on this flexibility and increase the pathways to opportunity and financial resilience for more Oregonians across the state through projects like OYA, or the ones our two IDA participants graduated from who will be also speaking today. So national and local research shows that the pairing of the coaching and financial education plus the incentivized match leads to especially effective in changing individual behavior and creating those solid financial management skills over time, especially related to savings. It's the idea that while you're learning all of these things you're supposed to be doing, you're actually doing them as well, and you're proving to yourself that these smaller habits can really lead to the achievement of much bigger lifetime goals. PSU's Regional Research Institute we've worked extensively with them as an external evaluator, and they found that the majority of our participants are graduating to continue saving after they've completed the program, as well as they continue to report increased confidence and ability in navigating financial decisions, even outside of the asset purchase that they're in the program for. Participants also describe their transition from feeling overwhelmed and lost to a new sense of hope, optimism, and stability for their household, and that is really the lasting impact, paired with the financial boost, of course, towards their asset purchase. As Claire mentioned, the initiative is funded by a 75% state tax credit on donations made to the Oregon IDA initiative, and that credit scheduled to sunset. That's why we're here. And all donations to the initiative, which have reached our cap of $10 million over the last few years, are jointly overseen by both Housing and Community Services as well as neighborhood partnerships. We qualify partners who compete for funding across the state. We conduct annual on-site performance reviews and continual monitoring, as well as provide ongoing technical assistance to our providers. So through this network, and this chart is on OLIS, it's under House Bill 2011 documents, we work with over 100 nonprofit organizations in all corners of the state, reaching all but one county, Wheeler County. We're still trying to establish a presence there. And some of these organizations provide direct service to clients, others manage networks of partners, and dozens others act as a referral network that aren't even captured in that $100 organization number. And then another one, it's our demographic data, which we're very proud of. This is labeled as Janet Bird's second testimony, and it's in the main section on OLIS. And it shows that we're reaching households with very low incomes and that our participants reflect the diversity of the state. We're looking at that very regularly with HCS to make sure that we're hitting the goals and benchmarks we've set. So just in closing, IDAs are an invaluable tool partners across the state are using to amplify the impact of the projects they already are offering. So maximizing that impact they have working with individuals to achieve those goals of building a more stable financial future for themselves and for their families. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Please.
Co-Chair Haas, Co-Chair Barnhart, and members of the committee. My name is Heidi Whitehouse, and I live in Northeast Portland, Oregon, and I'm here to express my support of this legislative measure.
And you might turn the mic toward you a little bit.
Thank you.
That's better. Thank you.
Thanks. I was proud to be the first member of my family to go to university, but when I got there, I was a 17-year-old girl with a dream of becoming a public school teacher and absolutely no idea how to achieve it. My industrious father earns a working-class salary, and my mother, though brilliant and supportive, did not have the bureaucratic or academic savvy to help me navigate the college system to my best interest. I graduated from Reed College in Southeast Portland in 2013 with a terrific, rigorous liberal arts education and the wrong degree. You can't be hired as a teacher with simply a bachelor's in liberal arts, which I discovered after it was too late to change my major. I was in a desperate position after finishing my undergrad. At 21 years old, I was up to my neck in $30,000 of federal student debt and seemingly no closer to my goal of earning a teaching license. I needed guidance, and I found it at Innovative Changes, who exposed me to the possibility of opening an individual development account. I first heard of Innovative Changes in my work at Friends of the Children, which is a Portland nonprofit organization where I work with high school juniors, seniors, and recent graduates who are dealing with poverty and a multitude of other adversities and risk factors. IDEA offered the perfect opportunity for these youth. It provided financial literacy classes paired with one-on-one support, which could turn these young people's part-time incomes into substantial tuition payments. As I helped my students qualify for and open individual development accounts, it dawned on me that this could be my solution as well. With IDEA, I could afford to earn my teaching license even on a modest nonprofit salary without going into further debt that would burden my future. I am now paying my way through Portland State University's Graduate School of Education with the help of IDEA. After a year in the program, I've earned straight A's, and I will be beginning my student teaching placement in the fall. By 2016, I will have earned a master's in education and my public school teaching license. I plan to teach here in Oregon, returning to low-income communities like the vibrant and resilient neighborhood where I grew up. And it's only with the support of Innovative Changes and the opportunity to build my assets through an IDEA that I have been able to pursue this lifelong goal of mine of becoming a teacher. Innovative Changes in the IDEA program coached me in financial literacy, helping me to not only better manage my current educational and personal expenses, but also to develop a manageable and achievable plan for paying off my student debt. Moreover, they helped me develop the necessary skills to navigate the bureaucracy of graduate education in a large public research university, skills that I am now able to pay for to the young men and women that I work with in post-secondary access. I urge you to empower future generations to experience the same opportunity, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Senator Haas, please.
Thank you. I don't know that I have questions for the panel. I have a question for the staff, maybe to explain. There's two sides here. There's one for the, I guess, wealthy investors who participate, and then there's the low-income people who participate, the people you're talking to. And so, of course, I just want to make sure I understand the mechanics of how a wealthy taxpayer pays. What does he get for $50,000? And the mechanics of how this works.
Sure. Co-Chair Haas, the contribution tax credit will be for the person who, as you described, the wealthy person who donates money. They make a contribution. They make a $100,000 contribution, just for easy math, and they get a 75% credit. So the $100,000 goes to the program to be used by the program, and that taxpayer gets a $75,000 tax credit. The $100,000 is funding for the program, and the participants in the program have to meet various income criteria. So they're low-income individuals. They participate with the program. They have various requirements of that participation, and eventually they graduate from the program, and any money they save in the program is then matched. And the contribution funds are the source of all of that money.
I need a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And this is, you know, this is obviously a wonderful program and serving a lot of people. But where these kinds of programs become inconvenient is when we look at this other side of it. And I don't think anybody up here thinks that our top priority is to help wealthy taxpayers receive a $75,000 tax credit. And so it always begs the question, there are lots of tax credits set up just like this. Would it make more sense for the state just to fund this $6 million a year or whatever it is, instead of going through this end around and giving tax breaks out to make it all work? So I just offer that up as a comment.
That's, of course, always the challenge, isn't it, in this situation? I'll go down the line. Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to explore what we just heard a little further on the hypothetical, because I find it interesting. The hypothetical, I think, was that we had a taxpayer who owns a business who owes apparently $75,000 in tax, but chooses to make a $100,000 contribution to this program. Am I right so far? That's the hypothetical.
Correct.
And then under this arrangement would be allowed to claim a $75,000 tax credit. Am I right, Chris, so far?
Correct.
Against her taxes, let's say. And so what happened is she writes a check for $100,000 to this program. And then she turns around, claims a tax credit, and reduces her taxes by $75,000, thus taking $75,000 out of the state's pocket and replacing part of the money she contributed. Do I have that right?
Yes.
So I want to make sure what just happened in light of our conversation with the Chief Counsel Dexter, who spent the money? I would say the state spent the money by encouraging this program. And that's why I like these opportunities to say two or three things. One, looks to me like we're the ones deciding to offer this tax break, but it's really a contribution to this program, is it not? So I just want to make sure I had I understood correctly what I just heard being said, and I want to make sure, Chris, are you with me on this, Chris? Because I went back to look at the definition of tax expenditures and found that indeed it is us spending the money, mm-hmm. and I just want to make sure I have this right, because mm-hmm. it's us deciding to reduce that lady's taxes by $75,000.
At least from an economist standpoint, the whole concept of tax expenditures has been the public redirection of public coffers.
Right. Darned economists.
Right. Representative Leininger, please.
Thank you so much, and thank you for being here today, panelists. I'm hoping you can clarify for me who qualifies for the IDA program from the saver standpoint. Is it, and when it comes to households with young adults in them, is it like student aid where really you're considered eligible based on your family's income, or do individuals just sort of on their own individual balance sheets qualify? Do any of you know? Does anyone know?
I can take that question. Co-chair Barnhart, co-chair Hess, members of the committee. So household income is calculated by how many people are in a household. So there are different thresholds by county, by household size, and that's largely determined at application with the IDA specialist and the client. And what classifies as a household, there's a whole lot of considerations that go into that, but basically speaking, it's who is sharing the finances and the budget. So things are taken into consideration, like who's paying rent, how are bills divided, and that's how that household number comes to be. The actual thresholds are established through data through HUD as well as HHS at the federal level. So those are recalculated every January if the data is available. Does that answer your question? So when a client applies, they provide pay stubs, all documentation of income, and then it's calculated based on that, those documents.
So I would actually be curious. Thank you so much for a follow-up opportunity. So I guess what I'm trying to suss out is I remember when I was, say, 20, and I probably made, you know, $5,000 a year as a 20-year-old because I was going to school and I was working in the summer and doing a student work-study job. But, you know, I was certainly connected to my family, you know, from a lifeline standpoint. But under this program, had I known that I could come to the IDA program, could I have come as a 20-year-old on a $5,000 a year income and qualified for support? How does that work?
Yeah, thank you. So it's a little bit nuanced. If the person is living the majority of the year in their own household, separate from their parents, paying for their own expenses, they could qualify as a household of one. However, we do have students, many students, in fact, I'm thinking of our program down that's based in Grants Pass through College Streams, who start before they go to college, and so they're calculated by their parents and household income and net worth. And so there's a whole lot of hypotheticals in between those two examples, but it's really, I guess, as much as I can boil it down, it's where the majority of the year is spent, who's paying the majority of the expenses, and where is that funding coming from, and often the parents are included in that calculation.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist, please.
Thank you, Mr. Coacher. I have a quick question of staff, just to make sure, because economist versus lawyer here again. So, in theory, following up on Co-Chair Hass's comments on the $100,000 plan, if an individual donated $100,000 and took a $75,000 tax credit, is there not a LRO in your guys' stuff? Forget about legislative council. I'm not sure there. But in the LRO and the tax structure side, could we not hypothetically, you know, eliminate the $100,000 piece, take the $75,000 in Treasury revenue, and then turn around and reallocate it to this program?
I believe the short answer is yes. I mean, okay, you're getting at the appropriation piece, right?
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you all for your testimony very much. That was a wonderful tee up for my question, which is, why don't we do it that way? And if you don't answer it right, I'll answer it for you. So it's a softball.
So I don't know if I have that answer, but my executive director might behind me, Jennifer, who hasn't testified yet.
And we'll get to her.
Okay.
Right.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I think the answer is because we've magically turned $75,000 into $100,000. And that's the point, is we could run it through all the machinations of our wonderful government system, take a little bit out for administration, take a little more out for administration, take a little more out for administration, pump it back out the back end, we've magically turned $75,000 into $50,000, or we can run this system, which you're doing a great job at, and turn $75,000 into $100,000.
On this topic?
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
I mean, I was just going to make that same point. It's not that they're getting the $75,000 that the state is paying out. They're getting $100,000. So in order to make that match, we would have to allot at least $100,000 through the Ways and Means process to make up for what they're currently receiving through this process.
Right.
Representative
Wetzel, please.
Hold government on.
So basically what you're saying, and I heard this presentation in the Human Services Committee in 2013 from, we had a young girl that came and testified, and one of her parents was a teacher full-time, and she wanted ballet lessons, and they didn't think they had the money for ballet lessons, so she came and she talked to our committee about how wonderful this was. I think what we're getting at is sometimes doesn't it just come down to a decision of what you're going to spend the money on? I mean, if you have a family and, I mean, I think that the level that you have set for receiving this money may be quite high. And I think that just from what I heard there, and further, when we talked about it, each group that distributes this money by county has their own criteria for the distribution. I mean, you just basically said that yourself. It depends on the area, depends on who's distributing the money. And so I'm concerned that we don't have a uniform across the board set of criteria that we're using to distribute the money out. and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's a different group in each county, and then there's only so much money, and so there's a big waiting list of people, and certain people get picked, and they couldn't really say how those people got picked. You know, I said, were they friends of the people distributing the money? Was it a lottery? Whatever. So there's a lot of sort of give and take or whatever in this, as I understand it from this other committee.
Do you want to take that? I think some of the later witnesses may have a comment on that.
Yes,
question
yes.
As well.
So on the first point, just for that, I remember that that young person and the ballet IDA that she had was funded through private foundation. It was just used as an example of the structure because her parents didn't qualify for the state funded IDA. So the state funds, it needs to be tied to post secondary education in achieving that degree. So on the income level, you'll see in our demographics, we're actually serving very, very low income people in Oregon, that even though our thresholds are at 80% area median income or 200% federal poverty level, our primary targets are really working with those folks who face really great barriers gaining those assets over time on their own. And to the uniformity comment, it's the flexibility. It's really in the program design beyond what's laid in statute. Our partners across the state absolutely follow all the same structure that's in statute and rule and in our standard operating procedures. The flexibility comes in like the culturally specific education offerings or how we do the one-on-one coaching. And of course, my director can talk a little bit more about that as well.
May I follow up? So
yep.
You said there's a private distribution. Is that what we were talking about with the division here? You said there's public distribution and private distribution. Could you explain what that was? Because that wasn't real clear in the presentation. Yeah. It was all lumped together as part of this tax credit.
So Chair Barnhart, Representative Whitsitt. So there are, we're here talking about the state funds today, which has that $10 million limit, annual budget limit. There are also federal funds through the Assets for Independence program, just to make it more complicated for everyone. And then there is also private foundations who will fund IDAs as well for different types of savings goals. But those five classes that we're talking about are within just the state funds.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony this morning. Heidi Whitehouse, Janet Bird, and Peter Haney, please.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. Thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Josie Benfield, and I'm from Cornelius, Oregon. I graduated from the Open Door Counseling Center's IDA program in March, so just last month. Open Door is based in Hillsboro. My financial goal was to obtain home ownership, and without the IDA, I don't think that this would have been possible for me. I did not have a strong support system in my life, and the IDA program provided that system for me, not only providing financial assistance for my down payment, but lending a hand for the what ifs, how about, and oh my God, now what do I do through the home buying process. The program was not solely centered around purchasing a home, but more about how to become financially stable and able to fully support myself. When I first started the program, I was earning very little, struggling to pay my bills, had no savings at all, and overall feeling hopeless. I lived in an unhealthy situation because I did not believe that I was strong enough, financially or otherwise, to do it by myself. Since going through the IDA, I have gained financial independence, confidence, and left that abusive relationship in my past. In the last month of owning my home, I have felt more safe and happy than I have in the past 5 years. I can't imagine where I would be today if the IDA program was not available to me. I can only imagine I would be in the same dark place that I was when I started. And I know not everyone's story is going to be like mine, but the program has so much potential to help so many different people throughout Oregon. I was provided a pathway through a process that is already scary,
and I felt confident and educated in every choice that I made because of the education and support that I received through the IDA program. I am now working towards saving for retirement. I see how hard my parents are still working and wonder what their life would be like today if they had a program like this provided to them. I can't thank the supporters, counselors, teachers, everyone involved enough for their help guiding me through this process. I have come from the darkest place that I could imagine to the most happy in owning my home, and I thank you all for your support.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm here to answer all of your wonky, detailed questions. I'm the executive director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and as you've heard, Neighborhood Partnerships has had the privilege of managing the Oregon IDA initiative with Housing and Community Services since 2003. There are a couple documents that are uploaded into OLIS. One is a two-page summary of what we hope to achieve with 2011. As you've heard, we're hoping to extend the tax credit mechanism, which just to get it out there, we're not wedded to the tax credit mechanism. It is what we have. It works. It does provide extra benefit. Unlike some tax credits, it does. We don't discount. We get extra benefit to the state from the credit. But we do want to extend the credit if there is not a substitute better mechanism offered. We would like to increase the amount of money moving into the initiative, so we're hoping to increase the cap on donations. And we want to expand the existing authorized savings categories. And I will maybe at the end walk through the list of that just in case folks have questions. But I'll talk a little bit about the tax credit mechanism first, and I think I'll get to some of the other questions that were raised. So contributors make or taxpayers make donations to neighborhood partnerships. We accept donations cash, online, and through stock contributions. We have kept a limit on the donations that we accept. It's an old agreement. I actually have a document that was Ben Westland and Jeff Merkley negotiated in 2005 and set a schedule, and we've worked with Housing and Community Services to keep to that schedule. For the last 3 years, we've raised $10,000 in contributions, so $7.5 million of state tax credit. All of that money comes into neighborhood partnerships. It's held essentially in trust. We actually keep it in many different bank accounts because we try to deposit money into accounts of the financial institutions that partner with our many nonprofit partners. All of those bank accounts are Oregon IDA Initiative bank accounts. They're monitored by us and by Oregon Housing and Community Services and audited regularly. Neighborhood Partnerships negotiates our operating budget every year with Oregon Housing and Community Services. We keep the administration of the program below 6%, and marketing by statute is less than 2%. We make grants allocations to qualified partner organizations. They're named in statutes fiduciary organizations. We typically make those allocations in March of each year, and we commit funds. We actually retain funds, which are managed by an investment committee that's run jointly with Oregon Housing Community Services, my board of directors, and representatives of our partner network. Money that we put out into our partner network, so it's 10 direct grantees. Three of those grantees are in and of themselves networks. So altogether, people provide organizations, nonprofits, and tribes providing IDAs to clients, total about 100 nonprofit organizations around the state. Of every dollar that we grant to those partners, They are allowed to use 5% for program administration, 20% for program delivery, which is the coaching, the business plans, et cetera, that you've heard about, the client support. 75 cents goes into match accounts for clients. So if you're going to do the math, and I know some of you will, of the 75 cents that the state spends, 69 cents actually ends up as match for participants in the IDA initiative. We think it's efficient. It is, you know, if you look at the 33% gain that the state is making on its investment, we do see that as a benefit to the program. So, as I said, we have capped contributions that we've accepted at $10 million for the last 3 years. We've actually turned money away in some years. We've gotten a little bit better at it the last couple years, and we just take the information off our website, turn off the buttons, and so we've managed to not have to actually return so many checks the last couple years. But we've been very diligent about maintaining that cap. Having had flat funding for 3 years, we are in a period where our partners have extreme waiting lists. Mr. Hanley, who is with our largest network, they have had to already cut off their waiting list. They're way over allocated, and have partners just clamoring for the ability to work more with clients and individuals.
And we are going to have to adjourn at 10 o'clock since both caucuses are meeting at 10. I had thought that we were going to have more time, and I was just reminded by my co-vice chair that that we have other obligations this morning. So I would like you to wrap up. I'd like to get to CASA and then take a couple of minutes for questions. And one of the things I would like you to address is the issue of the subscription rate for this tax credit, whether you think that it's whether it would be oversubscribed if there was more available, whether you think the amount of the credit is the right amount, or whether you could actually attract these contributions if the a tax credit was smaller as a percentage of the total contribution, and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
The issues you're talking about are really very fascinating, but they're not really of concern directly to this committee.
Okay, thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. So we feel confident that were we to be allowed to raise the cap on contributions, that we would be able to raise additional resources. We, looking at our donation history, we actually, while individual taxpayers can donate up to $100,000, we see a lot of smaller donors. We have a group of folks. We even have previous participants who choose to donate. So the contributions range from $15 to $100,000. But we do have a network of tax preparers, et cetera, who are ready to recommend to their clients that this is a way to make an investment to save money. As far as the 75% tax credit being the absolute sweet spot, I think we're open to having a conversation about reducing perhaps to 70%. I'd be nervous about going below 70%. We have the tax credit originally was a 25% tax credit, and that was a dismal failure. So we know 25% is too low. It may be that 75% is slightly too high and that we should be talking about a 70% tax credit. We're happy to have that conversation, and the expertise of legislative revenue staff would be welcome.
And I think it would be useful to get some comments from your accountants. Perhaps in writing, because we may not get back to this issue in this committee as a hearing on the question of what the possible federal tax benefits, if any, there might be to making this kind of contribution. But we'd leave that to the experts and the accountants who work on in this area. I'm sure you have some who would be willing to let us know what their opinion is about that question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Can we move on to CASA, and then let's if we have a minute or two, we'll have questions. And Mr. Mullen, is he still here? Oh, Do you need to be heard today?
No.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Peter Hanley, Executive Director of CASA of Oregon. CASA is one of the fiduciary organizations that's named in statute that basically selects those networked partners that we'll work with out throughout the state. We have 57 of them working in the state. You have my testimony in OLIS, so just briefly to address some of the issues I think are helpful on this. Some of the private foundations that we link up with help, particularly like the Oregon Institute for Colleges and Universities. They are trying to reach some sort of minority populations, and so we're able to help use these funds to match up with some of those foundation funds. We're also able to pull in about $6 million in federal money from the Treasury, as well as from Health and Human Services to match these programs. I think some of the important parts about this is it's not a standalone program. It's used as an adjunct program, and so it's really helping people either not get on to welfare or subsidy in the first place or helping them to get off of it. And I think having been before this committee many times over the next few years, I just want to say that I really appreciate that you've gone a lot further in asking that question right up front, is a direct subsidy versus a tax credit the way to go? So I just will stop there and take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have 5 minutes for questions, so we have the expert here, so let's ask them. No questions? Representative Leininger.
I just want to say that I've had the privilege of working with Ms. Bird and Mr. Hanley for over a decade, and I think there's nobody who's more devoted to doing good work on behalf of vulnerable people than you are. I just want to thank you for all that you've done for the community.
Thank you.
Great. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 50, Senate Bill 51, and House Bill 2011. And colleagues, we're going to reschedule Senate Bill 44, House Bill 2108, and Senate Bill 54. I apologize. I was thinking when we sat down here that we had until 10:45 this morning because that's the normal time. But of course, with caucus and floor at 10:30, caucus now and floor at 10:30, that simply isn't possible. And with that, the committee is adjourned. The committee is adjourned.